Good evening. We're holding Parshas Vayishlach, Parshas summary. Our Parsha begins with Yaakov sending messengers, angels, to Esav, his brother, to the fields of Edom, and he's telling him, "My master Esav, I've been with Laban these past 20 years. I've amassed a certain amount of wealth, and I'm sending you my messengers to tell you hi. I want to find favor in your eyes. I'm coming back. I want to make good." And when the messengers or these angels come back to Yaakov, they tell him, "Esav got word you're coming, and he's on his way. He's got 400 men. He's on his way to make war." And when Yaakov hears this, he gets very scared. He sees that war is imminent, and he divides the camp. He says, if Esav comes and destroys one camp, the other camp will get away. And he turns to God and he says, "God, you told me to come back to this land. Truth is, you promised me good things, and you gave me much more good things than really could be expected. I crossed the Jordan on my way out of Israel. I only had my staff, and now I'm this huge camp. Do me a favor, please, God, save me from my brother. Look at Esav, the way he's behaving, not like a brother. I'm scared of him. He's capable of coming and killing mother, children, everyone, and you promised me that you'd do good for me, that my offspring will flourish like the sand at the edge of the sea." So Yaakov has prepared strategically, he's divided his camp, he's prayed, and that night he goes to sleep, and before going to sleep he prepares gifts for Esav, and he sets them up as flocks. Each one is a distance from the other flock, and he tells them, when you pass by Esav, so if Esav asks you, "Where are you from? Where are you going?" So tell him that you belong to his servant Yaakov. He sent you as a gift before Esav, and Yaakov's coming up in the rear. And that's how he set up these flocks. And he figured, if I send him these gifts, then things will be okay. That night, he gets up in the middle of the night, takes his wives, takes his children, and he crosses over some river. We don't know exactly which river it was. And as he passes everyone over, he remains alone. And the man comes and fights with him till the morning hours. How's this happening? Where are all of his kids? What are they thinking is taking him so long that they could fight all night? Well, we don't know when the fight began. We don't know when this whole story began. We know that Yaakov had gone to sleep, gotten up in the middle of the night, and decided to start traveling by night. It's unclear why. And suddenly there's a fight with a man. We don't know who this man is. Obviously, we're getting an overview now. When we review with more depth, we'll learn more about this man. And when this man sees that he cannot overtake Yaakov, he hits him below the belt, literally, and he hurts Yaakov, but he can't do more than that. And he tells Yaakov, "Let me go. That's it. It's the morning. Nothing left. People who do my job, we work at night. That's it. Now I go to retire. There's nothing left. You can't win me. I can't win you." Yaakov says, "No, I can't trust you to let you go unless you bless me. If you show that you really agree that I won, so then I'll let you go." So he tells him, "What's your name?" So Yaakov tells him, "My name is Yaakov," which can be understood as one who will be with cunning. So he tells him, "You will no longer be called Yaakov, but rather Yisrael, for you have fought with Elohim," which can be understood as godly beings. It can also be understood as powerful people who have power, and with men, and you have been successful. And Yaakov asks him, "What's your name?" And he says, "Why are you bothering asking my name? It doesn't matter. It's not like we're going to talk again." So Yaakov gives a name to the place. He says, "Piniel, for I met face to face with Elohim." What does that mean? "And I made it alive," Yaakov says. So he gives the place a name, Piniel. The sun rises as he's leaving Penuel, and he is limping. So now he has to face up against his brother with his 400 men, and he is limping. He is wounded. And as a result of that, Vinei Yisrael, notice Yaakov just got the name Yisrael, and already the Pasuk refers to Vinei Yisrael, the offsprings of Yisrael, do not eat the Gidanasheh, which is somewhere over there on the thigh, because this man was hit Yaakov on the Gida Nasheh. And Yaakov, it's unclear whether he made it back to his family or not. In a second we'll see that it seems like he did. He looks up and he sees Esav with his 400 men. And quickly Yaakov divides his children and he passes before them. He bows before Esav 7 times. And Esav runs to him, he hugs him, he falls on his neck, he kisses him, and they both cry. And Esav looks and he sees the women, he sees the children, he says, "Who are these?" Yaakov tells him, "These are the children that God blessed me with." And then the wives and the children all bow before Esav. And Esav asks him, "What's all the different flocks that preceded you?" And Yaakov says, "I sent them to find favor in your eyes." So Esav says, "I have so much, I don't need that. You keep yours." And Yaakov says, "No, please take it, because I see you as though I've seen Pnei Elohim." Remember, that's what he saw the night before. "And if you're happy with me, please take what I've given you. God has blessed me, I have everything I need." And he insists, and Esav agrees to take it. And Esav says, "Let's travel together." And Yaakov tells him, "My master, you know that I have women, I have children, I have sheep. If I travel one day at your pace, all the sheep will die. You go ahead, I'll go at my pace. I have to take care of everything. I can't travel quickly. Eventually I'll get to you to Seir." And Esav says, "Okay, but I'll leave with you some of my men." And Yaakov says, "Why bother?" So Esav goes his way, and Yaakov travels to Sukkos. He never does catch up with Esav. He's not really interested in catching up. Yaakov makes it to Shechem in one piece. He's whole. He has his wealth. He has his Torah. And he hasn't been killed by Esav. So he purchases a piece of land for 100 coins outside of Shechem. And he establishes a mizbeach. He establishes a place of learning, an academy, to study the ways of Hashem. His daughter goes out. She wants to see the girls of the land. And Shechem, the prince, sees her. He takes her and he forces her to be with him. So he decides he likes Dina. And he speaks to her. After he's done whatever he pleases with her, he sweet talks her. He turns to his father and he tells him, "Take me this girl for a wife." Now Yaakov heard what had happened, and his sons were out with the sheep. So obviously they were a distance. They weren't so close, because some time has passed. And now the king, Hamor, the king of this area called Shechem, whose son, his name is Shechem, is the one who did this terrible act. He comes to Yaakov, and when he comes, Yaakov's children have come back. They've also heard what's happened. And they recognize that a disgusting act happened to Yisrael. Notice again, we have the name Yisrael, the name which was given by some stranger, as far as we know, in a fight in the middle of the night. And no one used to behave this way until now. So Hamor tells them, "You know, my son Shechem, he wants to marry your daughter." Notice, he's not apologizing. He's not even making reference to what happened beforehand. He tells him, "Please give the girl to my son as a wife. You marry us, we'll marry you, you'll do business here, you'll flourish here." And then Shechem speaks up and he says, "I want to find favor in your eyes. Tell me how much you want as a gift. I want your daughter." So the sons of Yaakov, they answer with cunning. They say, "We can't really give our daughter to someone that has a foreskin. We view the foreskin as a disgrace. When we want to curse someone out, we tell him, 'Oh, you're like those with foreskins. That's a disgrace for us. So if you want for us to agree, you have to be like us. You have to cut off the foreskin. Everyone has to have a circumcision. And then we'll give you our daughters, we'll take your daughters, we'll settle in and we'll become one nation. And if you don't listen to us, if you don't circumcise, we'll take our daughter and we're going." So Hamor and Shechem, they say, "Gee, that's a good idea." And the prince, he really wants Yaakov's daughter, so he's in a rush. They come to the people and they tell them, these people, look, they're not playing games. If they're playing games, then they wouldn't have made it so difficult. But they want to stay here, they'll do business with us. Don't worry, we'll take their daughters, whatever daughters we want, we'll take. Any daughters of ours that are having problems with shidduch, we'll give them. They have this little condition. They're saying that we have to circumcise. Don't worry, they got a lot of money, we'll be able to take it. We just have to agree to do this, and then they'll stay. So the people listen, and they circumcise. And on the third day, when everyone's writhing in pain, Shimon and Levi, they take their swords, they enter the city, all the men are bedridden, and they kill everyone. And they take Dinah, their sister, out of the house of Shechem. And when their brothers see what went on, so they come to the city and they loot the city. They take all the wealth of the city. And Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi, he says, you've disgraced me. What you've done can cause the nations of the land to fight me now. They could gather and attack and wipe us out. And Shimon and Levi answer him, what, so you think he should let our sister just be free? He could do what he wants? Yaakov doesn't answer them. God tells Yaakov, go back to Beit El. You remember when you left Israel, you went to Beit El, that place where you made a promise. As you were running from Esav, you made a promise that you'd come there and erect the temple and give a tenth. So Yaakov tells his family, he says, you took all this loot, among the loot there are idols and stuff that's forbidden, clean yourself, immerse yourself, get rid of the clothing that might have ornaments that have to do with idols, that might have designs that have to do with idol worship. And Yaakov takes it and he buries it. Years later it is discovered. That's why the Kuftim, the Shomronim, after the destruction of the first temple, when the king of the Assyrian Empire, Sancheriv, when he brings people from the island, possibly of Crete, Kavta, he brings them into the land of Israel. So these people, they find, one of the things they find is this loot, and among the loot they find a shape of a pigeon, and they start serving that. So this is dug up eventually after the destruction of the first temple, and these idols are worshipped once again. So they bury it and they travel, and God makes a miracle that the nations surrounding them are scared, that they don't chase after them. It seems like if they would have stayed in the same location, they might have had problems. Maybe the city of Shechem had treaties with other cities. But when they left, so they weren't chased, and they come to that place where Yaakov spent that amazing night, where he saw the vision where God spoke to him, and he erects a mizbeach. And at this point the Torah tells us something interesting. The Torah tells us someone passes away, and this is the first time we meet this person. It tells us that there's a woman by the name of Dvorah who was Rivka's wet nurse, which is interesting. The Torah stresses that when Rivka left her parents' house, she took her wet nurse with her, but we never knew her by name. Now suddenly the Torah says Dvorah, she passed away. Why does that make a difference? So we'll discuss that. And she gets buried over there. Seems like she was with Yaakov. Why is Rivka's wet nurse traveling with Yaakov? So they name the place Alon Bachut. Alon is a type of tree. Bachut is crying. And she's buried over there. God appears to Yaakov. He blesses him. And he changes his name to Yisrael. Now God has officially changed his name to Yisrael. And God blesses him and tells him that he will have nations and kings, and that he will have this land. Yaakov establishes an altar over there. He libates before Hashem oil. He names the place Beit El, which he did already last time. And they travel, and as they're traveling, Rachel passes away. She's in the middle of giving birth, and she passes away during childbirth. And Yaakov buries her over there on the path, and he establishes, he erects some kind of stone, a remembrance that this is Kever Rachel. And he travels, one of the ways of serving God, which was also adopted by idol worshippers, was to pour a liquid, either oil or wine or even water, in honor of God. And it was also adopted by the idol worshippers to pour it in honor of their idols. If you read Homer, Iliad, Odyssey, you see that that's one of the things they used to do. They used to pour wine before Zeus. Just like they'd bring sacrifices, they'd also pour wine. And that's why we have the concept of Yain Nesech, that non-Jews were so zealous about this that we would have to worry that any time they're touching wine, they're doing it, because it's a way of serving the god, which no one can tell. If you sacrifice my animal, I know about it. But if you take my bottle of wine and pour it out into a cup and say, this is in honor of you, Zeus, you pour it out into the cup and pour it back into the bottle, well, I wouldn't know the difference, right? So some non-Jews, some Gentiles would even believe that it's enough to just shake the bottle, and the movement of the wine was enough to be a libation in honor of the god. And that's why we're careful that non-Jews shouldn't even touch wine. Because of this, it's all an extension of this. There's more to it than that. If you want, remind me tomorrow night, we'll deal with it, with the whole concept of Yain Nesech. Now the Torah tells us something which is very unclear, that there's something improper happened between Reuven and his father's other wife, Bilhah. What exactly happened, we will discuss when we review the Parsha. And the Torah records that Yitzchak passed away, and the Parsha ends telling us how Esav, how his offspring fared, and who they married, and who their children were. And that's basically till the end of the Parsha. It tells us the kings of Edom, that's the end of the Parsha. Now let's review the Parsha with more understanding. Yeah. Sure.
I've heard somewhere that, I don't know, I tried to find it yesterday, and I heard that someone, the one person said that the reason that Yaakov goes through all this deception, like people are trying to trick him and him and cheat him and all of that, is Mida Kanei and Mida over what he did to his father and to Esau.
You could look over there on the spot in last week's parsha. There's a machlokas rishonim how to understand what Yaakov did according to pshat. You could look on the spot at the Ibn Ezra of the Rashbam. In last week's parsha we didn't go into it, but there's a in the Yetzer, yeah, when Yaakov goes in, the whole story over there. You could see the discussion. We're going with the pshat that I think is important to be familiar with. It's the more prevalent pshat in the Midrashim, and that's the pshat that your children will come home with, so I feel it's more important to stress that. In previous years, we did the esoteric Midrashim and the pshatim that were less well known. And this year I decided that it's more important to do the Midrashim, which you will encounter, which your children will quote to you. So I'm trying to stick with that, adding more depth and adding aspects that people don't know. That's why we didn't go into that. If you listen to last year's class, I think we did go into that. Okay, back to our parsha. As we always do before we begin our parsha, we have to remember where we left off last week. What do we see? Yaakov's traveling back to the land of Israel. Laban tries to catch up with him. They meet. They make a treaty. Yaakov leaves Laban and he encounters a group of angels. And when Yaakov sees them, he says, Machane Elokim Zeh, this is a camp of God, and he names the place Machanai. And our parsha begins with Yaakov sending out Malachim. He's sending out angels. And that's why our sages say that these Malachim is a continuation of last week's parsha. He met up with the camp of angels, so he sent them out to Esav. I would like to run through a segment of the parsha the way your children will come home and tell it to you, and then we'll review it a third time. So the midrashim that are usually quoted is as follows. Yaakov's on his way back to Israel and God sends him a camp of angels, and these angels are the angels of Israel. He's on his way back in, just like when he left, the angels of Israel left him and the angels of Chutz La'aretz came to join him. So to now, he's coming back into the land of Israel, so the angels of Chutz La'aretz are going to leave, and the angels of the land of Israel come to escort him. As we know, in the land of Israel, there's more hashgacha pratit. God gives greater protection to every individual in the land of Israel, specifically every Jew in the land of Israel. So he's getting the malachim of the land of Israel, and Yaakov sends them off to his brother Esau. And he thinks that his brother is going to show brotherly love. They come to Esau and they see Esau heard he's coming, and Esau's preparing for war. Yaakov prepares with three things: with prayer, with a gift, he's sending these gifts ahead, and he's preparing for war. And God sends angels to Esau, and the angels come in the form of these huge generals, and they come upon Esau's camp and they start beating Esau up. So they're beating him up, and Esau says, "Let go of me, what do you want from me?" And they keep hitting him. So he says, "My grandfather was Ephraim. What are you doing to me?" They keep beating him up. He says, "My father is Yitzchak. How could you do this to me?" They keep beating him up. He says, "But Yaakov is my brother." Oh, they say, "Yaakov is your brother. We're so sorry." They come up, brush him off, and they continue traveling. He's traveling a short while later. Another group of angels come. They grab Esav off his horse. They start beating him up. Again, Esav yells, "What are you doing to me?" So they don't listen. "I'm Avram's grandson." Doesn't work. "Yitzchak's son." Doesn't work. "Yaakov's brother." "Oh, you're Yaakov's brother. So sorry." Pick him up, set him straight. They keep going. And this happens a few times. This is to get Esav, to get the picture of where he's headed. And that's why when Esav comes to Yaakov, he says, "What was that camp that preceded you? What was going on there?" Yaakov prepares, and he's scared. Why is he scared? Because on the one hand, God made him a promise that I'll take care of him. But on the other hand, he says, maybe I didn't live up to my end of the deal. Maybe God won't maintain the promise. And then that night, after preparing each camp, the different flocks, and telling them, you greet Esav respectfully and tell him you're a gift from me, he sets each flock up and he tells the flocks, look, if you're all gathered together... So Yaakov figures if they're all gathered together, that looks like, wow, one big gift. But if you look and you see one gift, and you open up the wrapper, and it's very, very nice, and you get all excited. And then after you calm down from that gift, you look at the horizon and you see another flock coming. So he said, I know Esav, that's the way he likes it. Like there's more and more and more and more. When you see things in a row, one after the other, it seems like more. So he sets them up a distance. There's a distance between each flock. That night, he takes his wife and children. He stands over the Yarden, the Jordan, and he's like a human bridge. He puts one foot on one side, one foot on the other side, and he passes each one over the bridge, over the river. And then he remembers that he left behind these small earthenware vessels. Being that tzaddikim never steal anything, so their money is valuable to them because they take care that every penny that's earned is earned in a just way. So when you earn every penny that way, then every penny is more hard to come by, and then every penny is more precious. So Yaakov goes back for those cheap earthenware vessels, and when he's on his way, he encounters Esav's malach, and Esav's malach starts fighting with him, and Yaakov fights back. And the malach can't overtake him. And that morning, it was that malach's turn to go and sing before Hashem. Every malach is allowed once to sing before Hashem. And that morning, he was supposed to be there to sing. So as the morning comes, the malach sees he can't win. He says, "Let me go, it's morning time." And Yaakov says, "No." So after he's already wounded Yaakov, he says, "Please let me go, it's morning. I have to go sing before Hashem." And Yaakov says, "I'm not letting you go till you bless me." And the malach says, "What do you care that I bless you now? We're going to get to Beit El later on. There I'll agree that you deserve the blessings." And Yaakov says, no. "Now, before I meet up with Esav, I want you to admit that I'm really entitled to the blessings I took." And the angel sees he can't win, so he gives in, and he changes his name from Yaakov to Yisrael. And this is one of the strengths that Yaakov needs in order to face off against Esav. Now, Yaakov is limping, and God makes a miracle that the sun will rise early for Yaakov so that it will heal him. The sun has a healing effect. Shemesh tzedakah u'mapeh b'chnafeh. The sun heals. So God makes the sun rise early for Yaakov, and as Yaakov is limping, he sees Esav coming. So he quickly sets up wives and children, and he passes before them and bows before Esav. And Esav at that minute gets so upset, he says, I'm going to go and bite him in his neck and kill him. And he runs to Yaakov, sprawls on his neck, opens his mouth as if to kiss him, and takes a bite. And God at that second made a miracle, made Yaakov's neck become hard as stone. And Esav starts crying. He just took a vicious bite into stone. And about that second, the Song of Songs says, Tzavarech kemigdal hashen. Your neck is like the tower of ivory. Because that's what Esav bit into. So Esav is crying because he just bit into a stone. And Yaakov's crying because he's got a massive neck ache. And they're both standing there crying. And Esav asks him, who are all these people? And Yaakov tells him, this is my family. They all go down to bow. And Yosef says, I know him. He's got an eye for women and my mother's good looking. So Yosef, who's a kid, walks before his mother to bow to protect her from being seen by Esav. They all bow, and Esav asks him, what was that whole camp? Yaakov says that was to find favor in your eyes. So he says, Esav tells him, I got so much. Esav's bragging, I don't need your stuff. When Yaakov refuses, Yaakov says, I have everything I need. He answers gently. But Esav, he's busy bragging. And Yaakov warns him, he tells him, I see you. You look just like that Malach I saw last night. Yaakov's basically telling him, I took care of your angel. And if you want to start with me, fine, but I'm warning you, we already had it out with your angel. Esav takes his stuff, and he tells Yaakov, come, let's travel together, we're brothers. And Yaakov says, no, Yaakov does not want Esav's influence with his kids. And that's why Yaakov even refuses any of Esav's men's accompanying him. Yaakov tells Esav, don't worry, I'll catch up to you in Seir. What Yaakov is alluding to is what the prophet says, that at the end of time, God will send the Redeemer out to Seir, and he'll do business with Esav for what he's done to the Jewish people. Yaakov reaches the city of Shechem. He's whole, he's made it, he's not limping anymore, he's been healed. And he camps opposite the city, and he buys a portion of land, he buys a portion of the land of Israel. Establishes an altar and he calls out in the name of Hashem. His daughter wants to see the girls of the land and she gets abducted by Shechem. When they try to make the deal with Yaakov, so, yeah?
Rabbi, do we know where the location of this place, Seir, is?
Psukim seem to identify it. We'll have to sit down and look at the Psukim, but it seems that way.
Is it a mountain or is it a city?
I don't know. There are, based on the Psukim, it seems like we could identify where Seir is. When they offer the deal to Yaakov, they say, you'll marry whichever girls you want, and you'll give us whichever girls you want. And when they speak to the people of the city, they say, we'll take whichever girls we want, we'll give them whichever girls we want. They play both sides of the coin. And 3 days after they circumcise, Shimon and Levi come and destroy the city. They come to take Dinah out, and Dinah says, I don't want to go. Who's going to marry me? After this was done to me, who's going to want to marry me? I don't want to go. And Shimon promises her, I'll marry you. And then Dinah's already pregnant. So what are they going to do with the kid? All the siblings don't want this kid. They say, this kid was fathered by a Gentile. We don't want him here. So when Dinah gives birth to a girl, they take the girl and they put a special locket around her neck. And in that locket, they write the whole story that she's really Yaakov's granddaughter. And they send her down to Egypt, and she is a servant. She ends up being a servant in Potiphar's house. She is Asnas, who Yosef ultimately marries. When Yosef, in 2 weeks, is going to be riding around Egypt as the new young prince, so all the girls are looking out the window and they all throw out some gem, And this girl looks out the window, and all she has is this locket around her neck. So she throws it out, and it falls in Yosef's lap, and he opens it up, and he sees, hey, this is a Jewish girl down here in Egypt. He reads the story, and he says, I have to find out who it is. And he looks up, he sees her, and he sends his men, and he takes her for his wife. So that's the story that your children are going to hear in yeshiva. That's the story of our parsha, more or less, that your children will hear. Now we'll try to add a little bit more. Yeah.
So you said that Shimon married
Dan? That's according to one medrash what happened, correct?
Which means that the brother and his brother and sister.
All the Shvatim, the medrash said, were born with a twin sister who they married. So it says in the medrash. The Medrash says that all of the tribes were born with a twin sister whom they married. So this wouldn't be a first.
So he's married two sisters?
Right.
And he's living in
Israel? Right. So the Ramban obviously doesn't go with this Medrash, just like the Ramban won't go with the Medrash that Bilhah and Zilpah were also sisters. The Ramban has to go with the Pashut Pshat. It's not that way. Yeah. Let's get to that. It's a fair question, but let's go in order. We'll get there. The pasuk says, "Davar shalach beYaakov v'nafal beYisrael." God sent something to happen to Yaakov, and ultimately it fell upon the Jewish people. We've been discussing in recent parashios the concept of Maase Avot Siman LeBanim, and in our parasha, our sages stress it even more. They say that the whole story of how Yaakov dealt with Esav is really a sign for what would be with his offsprings. And many rabbis, going back to the time of the Gemara, when they had to deal with the Roman Empire, with the Christian world, before they went to do their dealings, they sit down and review the parasha of Yaakov's dealings with Esav, how Yaakov in our parasha deals with Esav. And it's interesting that the parasha begins with Yaakov sending messengers to Esav, and our sages automatically say he messed up. Our sages quote the verse in Mishle, "Machzik bo'oznei kelev over mitaber al riv lo lo." A person who interferes in a fight that really is none of his business is like a person who walks by a vicious dog and grabs and wags him by the ear, and then the dog obviously attacks. By the same token, our sages say Esav was headed somewhere. He was headed his own way. And when Yaakov sent him word and said, "Hey, Esav, I want to make good," Esav said, "Oh, yeah?" And then Esav got riled up and went to fight Yaakov. So the first thing Yaakov did in our parasha, our sages say, was a mistake. The rest of the parasha, our sages say, we will learn from how to deal with Esav. One of the things we learn from Yaakov is that one should not rely on miracles, and one should not rely on the fact that God is going to help him. Yaakov had a direct promise from God. God told him, "Hinei anochi imach, I'm going to be with you. Ushmaticha bechol asher telech, I'll watch you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to the land. I won't leave you," God tells Yaakov. Yet we find Yaakov's working day and night. Seems like a serious workaholic. He says, "I was working day in the heat, I was working night in the cold, I hardly slept." Yeah, he's working, he's making a living. He's not saying, "Well, God promised me it'll be okay." No, he's working. When he's dealing with the sheep, we see he's trying to figure out the way that he can make the most money off these sheep. When he makes the deal with Laban, and afterwards, when he follows through on the deal. Now in our parasha, when he prepares to deal with Esav, we see he doesn't say, "Well, God says it'll be okay, it'll be okay." No, he says, I gotta prepare. He prepares his children. He tells them, everyone wear your Shabbos clothing, wear your nice white clothing, and under it, wear your madin, wear your fatigues, be prepared for war. On the outside, we'll make like we're ready to be nice with Esav because we're not looking for a war. But we have to be prepared underneath. If he attacks, we have to be prepared to fight back. The rule is, Ashrei Adam Mefached Tamid. Praised is a person who is always scared. But that means scared and wary of what might happen. A person has to be on the lookout for the dangers that might endanger his life. But after a person has taken the necessary precautions, as Yaakov did, after that, what Rav Nachman from Breslov says, Lo lefached klal. A person isn't supposed to be scared at all. A person is supposed to be fearful. That means to be cautious, to prepare himself for the dangers. After he's done what he has to do, a person has to know, I did mine, now he has to go with full strength and without fear. And Yaakov over here, according to some interpretations, Yaakov's mistake was that he was scared. Yeah.
Being scared is a reflection of something wrong. It's not making it wrong to Hashem. Huh? It's like,
so we'll get to that. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. The pasuk says, Chirdat Adam Yiten Mokesh. The fear of a person will place before himself a stumbling block. And that's what happens to Yaakov. Because he's scared of Esav, he sends Esav word, he shows Esav he's scared, and automatically that gets Esav riled up. Our sages say that because Yaakov referred to Esav 8 times as my master in his dealings with him here, so it was decreed that there would be 8 kings in Edom before the Jews would have a king, and that's what the end of the Parsha enumerates, that there were 8 kings in Edom before there was a king in Israel. He sends, yeah.
Wasn't just because he said my master, if he hadn't said my master to Esav, would that have changed history?
That's what it seems like, yeah. And now we begin, yeah.
There are also like 8 Edomite kings between the destruction of the second temple and the third temple, something like that. 8
could
nations,
be.
And by this, if you assume there's 8 nations, then there must be 8 kings.
I don't know. Could be.
Because there's 4, but they come in pairs, so there's 8.
Oh, very nice. I didn't think of that. Very nice. It's a nice thought. Right? I don't know. It's a very nice thought. The Medrash says, and now we're going to begin analyzing what we do learn from Yaakov. The Medrash says that Yaakov sent word to Esav and he said, so said your servant Yaakov. And God said to Yaakov, you took what was chol, unholy, and you made it kodesh. You took Esav and you made him into the master. What's going on here? And Yaakov said to God, I have to be machnif. I have to sweet talk him so that he won't kill me. And from here our sages derive that in this world one has to know that you sometimes have to sweet talk a rasha. Now, it's important to recognize that this is only in reference to how you deal with him. If you have a powerful rasha walk into the room, you have to stand up. If a person, God forbid, finds himself in Iran, and the prime minister of Iran walks into the room, you better stand up. Not that he deserves your honor, but you better stand up. On the other hand, one is not allowed to praise the actions of a rasha. The Meiri says that anyone who praises a rasha is a rasha. When you praise a rasha, what you're saying in effect is, yeah, be like him, you'll get praise. That's also a good way to go. We show honor, we do things machnif, to sweet talk, to show like we respect them, because we have to protect ourselves. It says, "Anichnas teir v'smechim yismachim mahem." You walk into a non-Jewish city and it's Christmas. They're all celebrating. So don't walk around and walk in sackcloth. You have to show like, yeah, okay, Merry Christmas. Yeah, there's nothing wrong. Fine, yeah. Let's leave that for our halacha class. Yaakov sends word to Esav and he says, "Im lavan garti, I've lived with love until now and I've been detained." And our sages say he was alluding to Esav Im lavan garti, garti are the letters of Taryag. I've maintained Taryag mitzvos. So when I was a kid, that always bothered me, because part of Taryag mitzvos only apply to Kohanim. Part of Taryag mitzvos only apply to kings. Part of Taryag mitzvos only apply if you've stolen, you have a mitzvah to give it back. So how did Yaakov do all Taryag mitzvos? And then I encountered two concepts. One, our sages tell us that when you learn the halachas of a certain mitzvah, so if it's a mitzvah that you can't perform, God says, I'll consider your learning those halachas as though you've performed the mitzvah. So that's one possible answer. Another answer is, the Ramban writes in the beginning of the Sefer HaMitzvos that throughout Chazal we find the term Taryag Mitzvos refers to the whole Torah. So what he meant is, I kept the Torah in general. Taryag Mitzvos doesn't have to be taken to the T. That's my own, based upon the Ramban, that's what I think we could answer. So they tell him, we've made it to Esav, and you know what, you think he's your brother, he still is maintaining the same hatred towards you. It's interesting that when the prophet in Amos describes Edom's destruction, the prophet says, Ko amar Hashem, so says Hashem, al shelosha pishe Edom, for three of Edom's rebellious faults, val arbalo ashivenu, and when he hit the fourth, that's it, God says, that's a straw that broke the camel's back, for now I won't take him back. And this is interesting, by the way, that Amos has a whole section, I think it's about two chapters, that keep going nation after nation. They've done this much, and then they did one more, and God says enough is enough. So regarding Edom, what does the pasuk say? Al hotfo v'cherev achiv, he chased his brother with a sword. V'shichet rachamav, he abolished his mercy. Vayitrof la'ad apo, and his anger gore out for eternity. Ve'evrato shemara netzach, and his anger was maintained forever. And this is a trait of Esav. He's not willing to forgive. He maintains his anger. So now Yaakov's on his way back. He figures 20 years have passed. Maybe he'll forgive me now. And the messengers come back to Yaakov and they say, no, he's Esav. He's maintaining the same hatred. Yaakov feels bad. Why does he feel bad? He says, maybe I'll get killed and maybe I'll have to kill. What's so terrible if he kills? So one understanding says he was scared if he kills Esav. He knows Esav is loved by his father Yitzchak. So he's scared if he kills Esav, his father will curse him. He doesn't want his father's curse. He doesn't want his father's wrath. Another understanding says that Yaakov was scared lest he have to kill the 400 men. He says Esav's a powerful guy. Could be these 400 men don't have a choice. Could be he's telling them, if you don't come with me, I'll destroy you. So a non-Jew on the one hand is obligated to keep the 7 Noahide laws, but he's not obligated to give up his life for that. So if a non-Jew is told, kill or you will be killed, some say that non-Jew may kill. So Yaakov is saying, maybe those 400 men don't deserve to be killed. They don't have a choice but to fight me. I don't want to kill them. There's another understanding, and that is that Yaakov foresaw that in future generations his offsprings would be in the hand of Esav. And that's why he was scared. There's another understanding that says that Yaakov said, until now Esav wasn't willing to kill me. Why? Because Esav said, I'll wait till my father is dead, and then I'll take care of him. And now Yaakov gets word that Esav's coming to kill him. So Yaakov infers, that must be my father's dead. And that's why Yaakov got scared. That's why Yaakov was so fearful. He said, now there's nothing holding Esav back. Yeah?
But there are two things that go against each other. If he says he's...
Right, two different midrashim, right? Two different understandings, right? What does Yaakov do? He divides his camp. And our sages told us to diversify our investments. The first person we learn it from is Yaakov. He divided his camps. Said, I can't have everyone together in one place. If Esav comes to one camp, we'll fight him. Another camp will get away whether he likes it or not. And our sages said a person should diversify his investments, divided in thirds. A third a person should have in land. A person should invest in real estate, something that usually doesn't depreciate in value and is a constant. A third in business, that you can make a lot of money, you could lose a lot of money. And a third a person should have liquid assets, he should have on hand. He should have his cash. So Yaakov was preparing to fight. He said, we're going to divide it into two camps, and the one camp will escape, whether Esav likes it or not. And even though the Pesukim don't overtly say that Yaakov was preparing for a war, from here we derive that he was. And it's interesting, when we read history, so the history books very often don't mention the role that rabbis had in fighting wars. But if you read memoirs from the rebellion of the Warsaw Ghetto, you'll find that the rabbis over there had a very big role. And they said, guys, we're not going like sheep to slaughter. Get together and we're going to fight. The Torah doesn't stress that he's preparing for war, because that's, I think we could understand from that maybe the Torah is saying that's not the important point. Yaakov was saying, we're going to do everything so as not to end up in a war. If it ends up that way, okay, that's what it'll have to be. And we see that concept in Hanukkah as well. We're not celebrating the days that we fought the war. We're celebrating the day that we came to rest. Hanukkah, they came to rest, to camp on Chafei Kislev. Same thing with Purim. We don't celebrate Purim on the day we fought the war. We celebrate Purim on the day the war ended. We're happy we were victorious, but we're not interested in fighting wars. Yaakov prepares for war. He's not relying on a miracle. And our sages tell us we're not supposed to rely on a miracle. We're not supposed to allow ourselves to enter a situation of danger. Let's say a person has a mitzvah. It's a coming Pesach. We have a mitzvah to check for chametz. And there's a wall between my apartment, my house, and the neighbor's house. And in that wall, sometimes people place things. So the halacha says, you don't have to check deep into that hole. If there's a hole in the wall, that you're not obligated to check deep into that hole, because your neighbor, the non-Jew, will think, what's he doing in that hole? Must be he's doing some kind of witchcraft to harm me. And he'll get upset and he might harm you. So because in those days it was a common thing that if you wanted to do some kind of EGBG against the neighbor, you do it inside a hole in the wall between the two of you. So our sages said, you don't rely on an ace. You don't say, I'm busy doing my mitzvah, nothing bad will happen. No, you say, so I won't check that wall. Same thing is true with the Bris Milah. The Chochmas Adam writes, he says, people say, so the baby's a little bit yellow, he's not yet healthy enough, we'll do Bris Milah, it'll all be okay. So Chochmas Adam says, I testified before you, I saw foolish parents who said this and did a circumcision for their child when he wasn't yet prepared medically, and he died. So don't say that because you're doing a mitzvah nothing bad will happen. No, if you're doing a mitzvah, you still have to protect yourself. We don't rely on an ace. We don't put ourselves in situations of danger. Yaakov says to Hashem, he says, I must have become less because of all the kindness you've done to me. The Gemara tells us that Yaakov was scared. God did him a lot of favors. It's interesting that when we turn to God, usually we could list to God everything we've done right and why we deserve everything good. And when we look at tzaddikim, they're always working the other way. Tzaddikim are saying, God, you've done me so much good, maybe I don't deserve more. After everything Yaakov's done, such a tzaddik, he's still worried. Maybe I don't deserve more. The Gemara records that Rabbi Yanai, when he'd want to cross a bridge, so let's think back 2,000 years, the bridges weren't like today's bridges. So when Rabbi Yanai would want to cross a bridge, he'd first have the bridge inspected. He wouldn't cross a bridge unless the bridge was inspected. What? It says he inspected, so I guess he knew how to inspect the bridge if it was sturdy or not. And only then he'd cross over, because Rabbi Yanai taught us that a person should never place himself in a situation of danger and say, oh, they'll protect me from heaven. Firstly, Rabbi Yanai says, maybe they won't. Maybe things won't work out the way you think. And even if they do, let's say you cross the bridge and everything came out okay, if naturally you put yourself in a situation of danger and something bad could have happened, then they say in heaven, oh, we have to give him extra protection. He crossed the bridge that was dangerous, so we take off some of his merits. And that we learn from here, from the fact that Yaakov said, God, I have less merits. Why did Yaakov think he has less merits? Because even if things seem to work out okay, in order for them to work out okay, if you're in a situation of danger, God says, okay, to take off some of his merits for that. So people sometimes say, I'll travel in situations that are dangerous, I won't put on a seatbelt. You see, everything's okay. two things. A, no one's guaranteeing you that everything will be okay. And B, even if everything works out okay, if a person has placed himself in a situation of danger, he's lost. Yeah? We did not say that it is forbidden to put oneself in a situation of danger. We did say that in a different class. We did not say that in this class. So, no, because that's something that needs to be discussed. No, I purposely didn't want to open that one. It depends which kind of danger. Not every danger is forbidden. Some dangers are just not recommended. Some dangers are against the spirit of Halacha, but are not forbidden. We had this discussion a few times, but I don't mind having it again tomorrow night if you want to bring it up. We'll discuss it. Yaakov sends along sheep and goats, and the Torah enumerates how many males you need for each female, how many females each male could take. And our sages derived from that that there are different obligations of how often a person has to be with his wife. What the Torah calls ona. Ona literally means time. A person has an obligation to be with his wife set amount of time. Meaning, let's say a husband is home every evening, so then he's obligated to be with his wife a certain number of evenings out of the week. Because if he isn't with her that number of times, then she won't feel like he loves him. It's interesting that our sages showed us that we're supposed to have perspective of, this is what I'm obligated. I have to show her my love. If I won't show her my love this many times during the week, then she won't feel loved. And every husband's obligation is to make his wife feel loved. So our sages instituted, this is a Gemara, this is a Halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that every husband has a certain minimum. And they derived it, one of the sources is our Parsha, that Yaakov said, I know how many sheep, how many female sheep one male sheep could handle. How many female goats one male goat could handle. Why? Because how much time does he have to give them? So the same thing is true depending on a person's job. If a person has a job where he's out of town, he's in town only once a month, so our sage just said he only has to be with his wife once a month. That's his obligation. A person who's home more often will have to be with his wife twice a week, three times a week, four times a week, depending on his job. Now this obligation stems, it's not a question of this is how many times she's going to need or want to be with him. It's a question of how many times will he have to be with her as husband and wife in order for her to feel loved. And this obligation of ona that our sages established is also the minimum obligation of hishtadlut. How much does one have to try to bring kids to the world? We know Torah says pruervu, supposed to procreate, supposed to have one male offspring and one female offspring, minimum. Every person should try to have that. So what's a person supposed to do in order to attain that? What's the hishtadlus? So number one, you're supposed to marry a woman who could have children. You're not supposed to marry a woman who's 72. Marry a girl who could bring you children. Number two, how many times is a person supposed to be with his wife? So we say the amount of times depends on his job. That's this. This ona is also the amount of times that a person must be with his wife per week, per month, in order to fulfill his minimum obligation in trying to bring children to the world, to perform this mitzvah. He sets up his servants and he tells them, when Esav meets you, so one understanding is the way we've learned until now, tell him we're here as a gift for you. There's another understanding that says he set up each flock on its own and he says you start traveling. If you pass Esav and he doesn't say a word, good, you're free, keep going, you've made it. If Esav stops you, then that's what the pasuk seems to say. He gives them, he sets up each flock, he tells them you start traveling. And when Esav bumps into you, if he asks you, who do you belong to, where are you going from, where are you coming from, then say we're a gift for you. That night he gets up. What's he doing traveling in the middle of the night? That's not the time you think a person should travel. So one understanding says that he wanted to run away. He didn't want to meet up with Esav. So in the middle of the night he suddenly got cold feet. And he crosses, he takes his wives and children and he passes them over the river. Notice, he does this after the servants are asleep. He's taking care of everything else. Everyone thinks he's behind. He's following them. And now in the dark, when no one sees what's going on, he takes his wife and kids and he starts taking them over Ma'avar Yabok, which one understanding says over the Jordan, he's taking them into the land of Israel. And what? Yeah.
Was Rachel still alive?
Good question. We don't know when Rachel passed away. It seems pretty clear that the place where it is recorded in the Torah is not where it happened. We don't know when Rachel passed away. Rachel is still alive because she bows before Esau. But you're saying, what would the Ramban do? The Ramban will learn that this is a different river, Ma'abar Yabok. It's the crossing of the river Yabok. It's not the crossing of the Jordan. And Yaakov remains alone. And a man comes to fight him. We don't know who this man is. One understanding is that it's the angel of Esau. The prophet tells us that God does business in heavens and then on earth. When there's supposed to be a war between two countries, first in heavens, their representatives, their angels, have it out. And then whoever wins in heavens will ultimately win on earth. God first lets them have it out in heaven, and then whatever they do in heaven is represented by what happens in earth. So now Yaakov is going to have it out with Esau's Malach, and he's going to win. And after that, he could face up to Esau himself. So Yaakov is facing a Malach. And we mentioned that the Rambam says that Malachim never take on physical form. So if Malachim never take on physical form, so how's Yaakov wrestling a Malach? So it must be that this is all a vision. And that's why the Rambam learns that last week's parsha ended with Vayifgu v'malachei Elohim. Angels of God met up with Yaakov. Says the Rambam, doesn't mean that Yaakov was traveling, suddenly saw a caravan, and they all had wings, and he said, oh, those are my angels, welcome. No, the Rambam says, what the Torah is telling us is an introduction. Yaakov was traveling, and he had a vision of prophecy. He met up with angels, means he had the vision of prophecy, which later on in our parsha we encounter. He sees an angel, and he sees himself fighting with an angel. And this whole story of fighting with an angel and getting wounded, all of that, says the Rambam, is a vision of prophecy. As the Ramban disagrees with the Rambam. The Ramban says throughout Tanakh angels do take on physical form. So he asks, well, according to the Rambam, why is Yaakov limping? It was all a vision. So the Rambam could answer in one of two ways. The Rambam could answer that that was part of the vision. Or the Rambam could answer, maybe there are other ways. The Rambam could answer also that that sometimes a vision can have a physical effect on a person. Meaning, even though all of this was in a vision, it did have its impact on the way he walked. So Yaakov's fighting the angel, and for some reason the angel doesn't want to bless him then and there. And the angel hits him in his thigh. Why is this angel sent? So one understanding says, Yaakov wanted to run away. And God said, you're not going away, you're going to face Esau straight in the face. And I'll give you a vision that'll show you that you could face up to him. In this vision, Yaakov sees that he could overtake Esau's Malach. In this vision, Yaakov is told, you will no longer have to go in the sly fashion that you've been going until now, Yaakov, in a sly, underhanded way, but rather, you'll go straight and overcome him. And that's the name Yisrael. Another understanding says that this angel was sent to detain him. What's going on here? Yaakov has children who could take on a whole city. And yet, when comes time, that dangerous night, they leave him all alone. He goes back to get those vessels, and no one's with him. And he gets wounded. And when he comes back and he's limping, and they hear what happened, the kids say to themselves, that was terrible. We messed up. How could it be that we let our dad go alone? The middle of the night, none of the kids accompanied him. So the children said, we take on upon ourselves. From now on, we don't need that part of the foot. That gid anasha, we don't need anymore. It's a sign to remind ourselves we have to respect our parents more. No way could such a thing happen that our dad goes back all alone and we don't help him. It's interesting to see the difference between parents caring for children and children caring for parents. Next week's parsha, we're going to see Yaakov sends off Yosef. He's sending him to meet the brothers. And the Torah tells us, Vayishlechel Memek Chevron, he sent him from the depths of Chevron. All you guys know, Chevron is on the mountain. Chevron isn't in the depths. So our sages say, yeah, Yaakov was sending out his son from Chevron, and he accompanied him from the mountain down to the valley. Because when he sends his son away, he accompanies him, he cares for him. The children, they can let their father go alone. But Yaakov, he knows, he loves his son, he accompanies him on his way, at least part of the way. We know that when a person comes to the city, there's a mitzvah, levayat, to accompany him. The Torah says, let's say you're traveling, let's say you come out of a city and you see there's a dead man, you see he was murdered. So there's a whole procession, we try to find out who murdered him. And if we don't know who murdered him, so what we do is we call the elders, we measure from the corpse to the closest city, we bring elders out from Jerusalem, we do a whole ruckus, we do a whole tararam, we measure to the closest city, we say this city, the elders have to come out, we take a young calf, we do a special procession with that calf, we slaughter that calf, and the elders have to say over there, we did not spill this blood. So our sages ask, why does the Torah say the elders have to say, we did not spill the blood of this man? What we think the elders are, murderers? What the elders are saying is, this man did not come to our town and leave without the proper accompaniment. This man did not come to our town without our treating him right and accompanying him the way we should. Our sages say that in next week's parasha, when Yosef leaves Yaakov, Yaakov was in the process of teaching him these laws, the laws of Egla Arufa, this calf, the whole procession that's done when the calf is slaughtered. And in a few weeks, when we'll read how Yosef reunites with his father, he wants to identify to his father that this is true, he really is Yosef. So he sends word back to his father, he says, I'll remind you, Dad, the last thing we learned 20 years ago was this concept of Egla Arufa, that you have to accompany a person. And what is that concept that they were learning? That's what Yaakov was accompanying him. When Yaakov sends Yosef off, he's accompanying him, he's teaching him this concept. You don't let a person go off alone. And when Yosef comes to bring his dad back, so he sends him the special calves from Egypt, the special wagons, and he tells him, Dad, I'm accompanying you, I'm taking you back. This is the last concept you taught me, that you don't let a person go without accompanying him. But in our parsha, Yaakov's children erred. They did not accompany him. And because they didn't accompany him, he had this fight and he was wounded. Another understanding says that the fact that we don't eat the Gidah Anashe is a sign of pride. We're saying, our great-great-great-grandfather, he fought with an angel, and all the angel could do was hit him in his thigh. That was all he could do. But we have the name Yisrael. Yisrael means those who could deal with gods, with godly beings. It always bothers me when they say an Israeli Arab. I always say there could be a Jewish Arab, there cannot be an Israeli Arab. The term Jew means believing in one God. Well, Arabs believe in one God. Israelite means one who comes from Yisrael, from Yaakov, one who has the potential to overcome the forces of nature. That's the name Yaakov was given in our parsha. You overcame the angels. There's no such thing as an Israeli Arab. An Arab is not an Israelite. You could be a citizen of the state of Israel. You cannot be an Israeli Arab. What people call a Jew is really an Israelite. What people call an Israeli, well, that's citizenship. So Yaakov is wounded. And our sages say that when Yaakov was wounded, the angel was able to affect all the tzaddikim in generations to come. And this, our sages say, refers to the generation of Shemat. There were generations where the Jews were tortured and were hurt, and our sages were hurt. The Gemara records examples of this as the generation of Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba. We learned about on Sunday that they tried to abolish the smicha. They killed anyone that would do smicha. And when Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba finally gave smicha to the five disciples, they came and they shot arrows at him. They cut him to pieces. The Ramban quotes that this refers to the generations of Shmad, that they used to take balls of metal and heat them up in the fire and put them in the armpits of people and kill them that way. And the Ramban says we've suffered this and worse than this, and this is what's alluded to by the fact that the angel could hurt him by hitting him under the thigh. But ultimately, Yaakov makes it in peace to Shechem, and that's because ultimately we'll make it back, we'll make it in peace. We will make it. The Jewish people as a people, that doesn't mean that individuals on the way won't suffer. No, the contrary. From here we learn that individuals will suffer. Now, after we finish the parasha, we're going to analyze all the suffering that Yaakov goes through, and we'll see how much of that we're supposed to learn about our history and our future. Yeah.
I heard a similar time, only it was they were using the word Israel and two different interpretations. One was Rabbi Gons is from about 30, which I struggled, and the other one is Tsar as in prince.
That's
so
it?
They struggle, but in the end they're going to overcome.
Okay. Okay. What?
Would it make sense to say
could be. I don't know.
Would
that make sense? The angel sees he cannot overtake Yaakov. The pasuk says that the tzaddikim are giborei koach osei dvaro. They are the mighty ones who perform God's actions. And here we see that might, that Yaakov can fight an angel. Now, what does that mean? Angels can destroy a person like anything. I mean, what it means is that God doesn't allow them to harm the tzaddik. The angel couldn't harm Yaakov, not because he wasn't physically able to, but because God did not allow him to. Why did this all begin? Because Yaakov went back for pachim ktanim, for small vessels. A little over a week ago, there was a big Tam Trachm who passed away. The name Rav Waldenberg, also known as the Tzitz Eliezer. And a friend of mine, his father owns a pharmacy right near the Shuk, and he told me that Rav Waldenberg used to frequent their pharmacy. And he'd always bring back the same plastic bag. So once they asked him, you know, we could give you a new one. So he said, yeah, but this one works fine. Why give me a new one? That's this concept of pachim ktanim. We live in a world that everything is disposable. Well, our sages taught us to value things, to be careful to take money that belong, that only money that we're entitled to, and not take anything that we're not allowed to take. And if a person behaves that way, then his money is more precious. And that's why we find that tzaddikim are always very careful about their money. They pay what they owe, but they're careful not to lose their money because they know how hard honest money is to come by. Why was Yaakov damaged? If this angel can't hurt him, so then how come, well, hurt him he was able to. How come? So one understanding says that the reason was because he was scared. When a person has a job to do and he's doing God's job, he's not supposed to be scared. The same thing we see that Moshe Rabbeinu, when God tells him, go take the Jewish people out of Egypt, he's scared of Pharaoh. He says, God, send someone else, don't send me. And that's why when he begins his travels to save the Jewish people, he is attacked. An angel attacks him on his way. Now, this idea is written in the Chizkuni. I think that what we could expand on the Chizkuni, I think what he means to say, is that when a person is scared of something other than God, so God sends him an angel to contend with, and he sees that he makes it alive. And after contending with an angel like Yaakov did, and like Moshe did, and making it alive, then one recognizes that everything else in this world is small fry. There's nothing to be scared of, Paro. This isn't written in the Chizkuni, but I think this might be what he means. He's limping. And on the one hand, he has to enter this war limping. So this is something that... this is a message for him. You're going to make it, and not because of your strength. On the other hand, think of Esav's Malach. The one time in his life, he could sing before Hashem, and he's willing to give that up, he's willing to endanger giving that up, just to harm us. The sun rises for Yaakov. The Torah describes it as the sun rising for him. And it's interesting, sometimes we have to have that perspective. We have to recognize everything God does is for us. A person can wake up in the morning and see the beautiful sun and say, yeah, that's nature. That's what the sun does. And yet, the Medrash says, what's a tzaddik? A tzaddik is someone who wakes up in the morning and he sees the sunrise and he says, God, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for making such a beautiful sun. And he blesses God. He says, Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you Hashem. Elokeinu melech haolam yotzero, you created light, borech hoshech, you fashioned, you made darkness. You made everything. So obviously, halachically, we don't say a person should make that blessing, but a person should show that appreciation. Yaakov sees Esav coming with his 400 men. He divides up the children. He goes first and bows. Everyone else bows. So all 11 tribes have bowed to Esav. And as such, all 11 tribes will not merit to have the holy part of the Beis HaMikdash in their section in the land of Israel. The only one who will merit it is the one Shevet that did not bow to Esav, the one who was born in the land of Israel, and that is Binyamin. So Yosef and his mother, everyone bows. Say bow, what do you mean by bow? You mean like kneeling on one's feet? Kneeling and bowing totally? Or bowing like this? Because bowing like the Chinese do, leaning forward. So it's brought that was the custom that everyone used to do that in saying good morning. They used to bow down. So much so that some say that the prohibition of saying good morning to someone prior to prayer is only either if you go to his house to greet him or if you bow to him to say good morning. And what are you bowing to him before you bow to your Creator? So we see from there that it was understood that when you said good morning, you bowed to a person. So that much bowing seems to be okay.
Yeah.
The halacha is based in part on the customs that were accepted in those times. We see that the Chinese seem to maintain that custom which was accepted in those times. Okay. So more than that, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. There are a lot of things that were done then. We don't learn halacha from the Torah. A lot of things we could say. We have to open up Gemara and learn it, and learn the Shulchan Aruch, and learn it. I don't know. I could bring you sources, but he's asking a halacha question. I don't know. Okay. Okay, fine. So they hug. And there are two opinions among our sages when they kissed and hugged. Was that the one time in Esav's life that he really loved Yaakov and that's why he cried? Or did he really hate him then and wished he could kill him, but so he could not? At this point, our sages say, Halachayi, we have a tradition, Beyadua, it is known, Sheisav Sonel Yaakov, Esav hates Yaakov. And working off that premise, our sages say, was this the one exception? Or was this also part of that Esav always hates Yaakov? Yosef stands before his mother. He says, I don't want him to see my mother. And because of that, Yosef is called Alei Ayin, one who overcame the eye. That's why the Gemara says that, the Gemara records the following story, somewhere over here. Gemara says, Rav Yochanan was a very beautiful person. He had extra long eyelashes. Rav Yochanan is the one that compiled the Jerusalem Talmud. He lived in the land of Israel. He used to go and sit next to the mikveh. And this way, when the girls came out of the mikveh, they'd look at him, and they see his beauty. And we saw in last week's parsha that what a person sees prior to conception can affect, or even during conception can affect, what their children will be like. And he said, they'll look at me, they'll see how beautiful I am, and they'll all have beautiful children like me. So the rabbis asked him, aren't you scared of Ayin Hara? So today, it is improper and immodest for a person to be around the mikveh during the evening when women go there. A person is not supposed to be there. There's a cherem ha-geonim. The Geonim instituted a cherem against any woman or person that mentions what night a woman goes to mikveh. One is not allowed to discuss it even. That you will learn about when you guys are chasanim. But in those times, obviously, you didn't have the cherem yet. And anyways, he couldn't see. Rav Yochanan, in order to see, would have to take tweezers to pick up his eyelashes. So he didn't have to worry about seeing the women because he couldn't see. The Gemara says that Rav Yochanan couldn't see. He had special gold tweezers with which he'd lift his eyelashes in order to see. He had extra long eyelashes and he couldn't see. The Gemara says that he was learning and a guy kept asking him and making his life difficult. And finally he said, I want to see who this guy is. And he picked up his eyelashes, and that guy had a broken chin. It was Reish Lakish, and he thought the guy was laughing at him, that he stumped him again. So he felt bad, and that night Reish Lakish died. So a while later, Rav Yochanan was learning, and again, he's learning, and he asks a question, and a kid answers him. He asks another question, and the kid answers him. So he sees, hey, I got a sharp kid before me. So he's looking for those tweezers to check out who's this kid. And his sister, who was Reish Lakish's wife, she was the widow of Reish Lakish, he gave his sister to Reish Lakish. So his sister, it was her son, meaning it was Reish Lakish's son, just like the father was able to stump him, Reish Lakish, so too his son was able to stump him. So his sister ran in and grabbed her son and said, get out of here, don't let him do to you what he did to your father. So Rav Yochanan didn't see. By the time he opened his eyes, he couldn't see who was there. But Rav Yochanan really couldn't see. From these stories we see that Rav Yochanan really had a problem seeing. Rav Yochanan was once traveling and he saw a young man who had once been part of the Beis Medrash named Reish Lakish, and he saw him leap across a river, and he said to him, young man, that might, if only it were back in Torah, you'd do so well. And Reish Lakish said, and your beauty, if only it were in a woman, that would be so good. So Rav Yochanan said, you join the Beis Medrash, I have a sister who's better looking than me. If you come back to the Beis Medrash, I'll get you my sister. And that's what happened. Reish Lakish said, fine, I'll go learn Torah. So he said, okay, come join me. So Reish Lakish said, okay, but now I can't. Then Reish Lakish couldn't make it back across the river, because the second a person accepts upon himself the yoke of Torah, so Torah saps one's strength. Torah takes off one's strength. You will see that when you're studying in college, you could work on half a battery. You could work when you're very tired. But when you're learning Torah, if you want to get the Gemara well, you've got to get a good night's sleep. You can't learn Torah without having all of your strength. So the second Rav Reish Lakish accepted to learn Torah, he couldn't jump back. Now, he had learned Torah once before. And now, eventually, when Reish Lakish picked up his eyebrows that time, he didn't know beforehand that Reish Lakish had this broken jaw, or maybe he didn't have it in the past. And then he thought he was laughing. So let's just finish this section in the Gemara. Yeah?
How did he compile the Gemara?
We have Rav Yosef in the Gemara who is blind. We have Rav Sheshet in the Gemara who is blind. When you compile, it means them with their base medrash, that they headed the show. That's not me who says that. Rashi says that. And Shabbos and other places. So when we say they compiled, it was them together with their base medrash.
Didn't you say that midrash before with Rashi?
Not me. Could be. So Rav Yochanan used to sit by the mikveh. When the girls came out, they'd see him, and he said, this way they'll have children that are beautiful like me. We see here that having beautiful children is an asset, or maybe he felt it would be good for them. Whatever. At any rate, the rabbis asked him, aren't you scared of Ayin Hara? Everyone looks at your beauty. Aren't you scared of Ayin Hara? So he said, I come from Yosef. And Yosef's offspring don't have to worry about Ayin Hara, because they were blessed by Yaakov ben Porat, Yosef ben Porat, Alei Ayin. The children of Yosef, they are over the eye. They make it, the eye can't harm them. And Rabbi Abbao says, Rav Yosef, Rabbi Hanina says, how do we know that? from one verse, and then we bring another explanation that because so Yosef protected his mother from the eye of Esav, and Ayin Hara cannot harm Yosef. Another understanding says that Yosef didn't want to enjoy seeing something that wasn't his, Potiphar's wife, so that's why Ayin Hara can't harm him. At any rate, Yosef cannot be harmed by Ayin Hara, and in our parsha he protects his wife, his mother, from Ayin Hara. Yaakov comes to the city of Shechem and he is whole, and he camps opposite the city. Our sages say when he camped opposite the city, he instituted some things to benefit society. One understanding says he instituted bathhouses. He came to a smelly place. He said, these guys never shower. I got to institute bathhouses. Another understanding says he paved the roads for them. Another understanding says he implemented a monetary system. He implemented coins so that they'd have a better economy. At any rate, we see that when a person is saved from something, he has to do something for society. This is very often people think, I'll make a Suda today. I'll make a feast to thank God. That's very good. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't do something to help society. Yeah.
Descendant of
Rabbi Yochanan is a descendant of Yosef. That's what he said.
So, he's one of the 10
Moss
tribes.
Right? Could be. That's a good point.
Started out descendants of
Shaul,
like from
Shaul's daughter. I don't know. So they buy a portion of the field, and then Dina goes out. Now the story of Dina, I think we'll deal with tomorrow night. Tomorrow night we have class. So let's just finish a little bit an overview, a little bit. We'll finish the parasha and maybe we'll go in depth in a few more, we'll attack a few more points tomorrow night. When Dina is abducted, so her, we see a few things. A, we see another bad thing happening to Yaakov. Think a person as pious as Yaakov who lived happily ever after. And the Torah keeps telling us, no, it doesn't work that way. If you're a good person, then you got to be prepared to deal with hardships in life. There's a medrash that says that any person that has 40 days in his life without a problem, without some serious problem, well, that person should know he's enjoying the world to come in this world. I don't know. So until this point, until this man did this, the nations were very careful, each one to be faithful to his wife. And once Shechem showed that it's a free-for-all, he as a prince did what he did, it brought the world down. And in the land of Israel, there started being problems with incest, all kinds of forbidden relationships, forbidden for non-Jews. And ultimately, this is what caused these nations to be kicked out of the land. Until this day, until Shechem went ahead and took this girl against her will, until he showed that you could do whatever you want with women, the people in the land of Israel were very careful. They knew the Mabul had wiped out the world, and the Mabul came because people had done improper things with women, so people were careful. And once Shechem did this, so everything started going downhill, which ultimately resulted in their being kicked out of the land. God says to Avram, they haven't sinned enough to deserve to warrant kicking them out of the land yet. And now, once Shechem does this, so everyone starts slowly but surely, it affects everyone. And this is one of the things we've been discussing lately, that people have to know that their actions have a ripple effect. What you do isn't only you. It causes other people to do things as well. Yeah.
What was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah?
Sodom and Gomorrah were gone.
Sorry?
Sodom and Gomorrah were gone.
I know, but you said it was the first time
Do you have a you're saying Sodom and Amorah wanted to do something improper? It's a good point. I don't know. What do we say about Sodom and Amorah? I don't know. What I said is Chazal, but it's a good question. I don't know. I'd look into it. It's a good question. We'll continue tomorrow night. I want to mention one thing that.